Subscribe to our free newsletter. Sign up at the RN homepage.
This is Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au. Welcome to the program. I'm Paul Barclay. As strange as it might sound, one of the more popular talks we've put to air on Big Ideas in the last couple of years has been on the subject of, wait for it, accounting. A topic so famous for being boring, there's even a Monty Python sketch on it. Jane Gleeson-White's tale of how 500 years ago, the Venetian method of double-entry bookkeeping changed the face of modern commerce and capitalism forever was compelling. In her book, Double Entry, Jane not only outlines the role of an Italian Renaissance monk and mathematician, Luca Pacioli, in the development of accounting, she shows us the importance of numbers and of measuring financial affairs to modern society. Ultimately, she asks, does 21st century accounting need updating? Should social and environmental costs, externalities, be included in the balance sheet? These questions flow from Double Entry and into the sequel, which we're about to talk about tonight, Six Capitals, The Revolution Capitalism Has to Have, or Can Accountants Save the Planet? Could it be accountants and corporations who come to our rescue rather than the politicians, scientists or environmentalists? I spoke to Jane Gleeson-White in our Brisbane studio after our scheduled bookshop conversation was cancelled due to a fierce hailstorm in Brisbane that left the bookstore without power. I wanted to start by asking you about how one becomes an intern at the Peggy Guggenheim Museum in Venice. This sounds like a plum position.
It's a plum position. It's a perfect question to start with because it was, of course, my way into accounting most unexpectedly. One gets a position as an intern at Peggy Guggenheim Museum in Venice by finishing an arts degree and having no idea what one wants to do and happening to go to an exhibition at the Art Globe New South Wales of the Solomon Guggenheim Museum in New York, where I met the marketing director who said, what do you plan to do, you know, now that you've finished your university degree? And I said, I'm not sure. And she said, oh, you should apply for an internship at the Peggy Guggenheim Museum in Venice. Did you know there was such a thing? And I said, no, I did not know there was such a thing. And so I applied for it, never having heard of it. No Australian had ever gone before. And I got it. And it was, you know, obviously the most fantastic thing you could possibly do.
What a fortuitous meeting. My goodness, man. So that sort of really put you on the track to writing the books that you've come to write. Because Luca Pacioli, the Italian Renaissance monk and mathematician, is one of the key figures behind the development of double-entry bookkeeping.
Yeah.
But I thought that we should remind the audience about what double-entry bookkeeping is, its origins, and really how it changed everything in the world of international business.
Yeah, well, that was the most fascinating thing once I started looking into this strange juncture of accounting and Venice. Is I started to follow the implications of double-entry bookkeeping and realise that really it had shaped the world, and no one really thinks about that because it's too dull to consider. but I discovered that the northern Italian merchants during the Crusades, which brought an economic boom around 1300 to northern Italy, had started, their businesses were so enormous they could no longer keep track of their daily, you know, movements just in their diaries. So they began to keep their books in a different way and eventually developed this system, which we call double entry bookkeeping. They used to call, you know, bookkeeping alla Venezia or alla Florentino. So it was particular to various cities. And effectively what it did was it removed all the extraneous information of the diary. It removed all the stories. You know, I went to Pisa and sold a cow to Luigi for this amount of money. All that information was extracted. And all that was left was if they sold a cow was a credit to the cow account and a debit to the cash account. So that cash account was increased by the amount that the cow was sold for. So all that remained were numbers and money. And eventually, after Luca Pacioli codified that system and published it in Venice in 1494, it actually, because he published it in book form, the latest technology of the day, it spread across Europe eventually to Britain, where during the Industrial Revolution it was applied to factory accounting and then to the United States, and it now underpins our global economy and, in fact, an accountant could actually learn double entry bookkeeping from Luca Pacioli's 15th century treatise.
If someone is a creditor, then someone else must be a debtor,
yeah.
and the credits and the debts must all even out.
Yeah.
It's so simple,
yeah.
and it's so ingrained in the way we think now. Why was it so fundamental? Well, first of all, how did business exist before that principle? And then why was it so fundamental afterwards?
Well, business didn't really exist as we know it before that. I mean, I suppose people traded, but that was much smaller and they went to trade fairs. And as I said, they recorded their accounts in diaries or with notches on a stick, a tally stick, which the Bank of England, I think, used till, you know, the 17th century or something. But also it was a feudal system. So what the double entry system, it emerged at the same time as mercantile capitalism did. And what it made possible was the measuring of profits and losses. So gains and increases in a merchant's capital, which was his worldly goods. So in the double entry bookkeeping accounts, the word capital was first used for wealth, and hence the word capitalism. You know, so really capitalism emerges from double entry bookkeeping. And in 1902, a German economist published a book saying that capitalism and double entry bookkeeping are, you know, effectively chicken and egg. Who knows which one came first?
Oh, right. So yeah. Double entry bookkeeping established the notion of capital.
Yeah. And its increases and decreases. And Pacioli made clear that the pursuit of profit was the purpose of every person's business. So suddenly, business went from being a sort of more organic, slightly, you know, random occurrence to being slowly, gradually, it built up first in Italy, then across Europe, Germany, Holland, UK or Britain, the United States, and commerce became the pursuit of profit because profit was able to be measured by the double entry bookkeeping account. So it completely changed the ethos and purpose of business and effectively gave birth to capitalism. And even Karl Marx, you know, it was really interesting looking more deeply into it. He didn't ever write about it in his books, but in his letters to Engels, he quizzed him constantly about how Italian bookkeeping was used in his Manchester cotton manufactory, which was one of the most advanced ones of the age, and therefore trying to apply this new form of bookkeeping to the industrial production. So, you know, fascinating underpinning of the whole world.
And it was Wedgwood, the makers of fine ceramics, you tell us, who were one of the first companies to realise the importance of double entry bookkeeping as a management tool.
Yeah, that was so wonderful to discover. So Wedgwood was incredibly successful. You know, men and women packed out his London showrooms. He couldn't have he couldn't make enough vases to satisfy their need for them. But suddenly one year he had a cash flow problem and he needed to work out whether he should cut production of his vases or increase prices, you know, so it's a sort of common problem. And to answer his, you know, problem, to solve his problem, he analysed his accounts, and in doing so, he worked out the difference between fixed and variable costs. So he realised that, you know, no matter how many vases he made, he was always going to pay wages. He always had the factory, he always had the machinery, he always had the moulds. You know, there were certain costs that were just integral to the business. And then there were other costs which were variable and depended on how many vases were made, like the clay and the other things that went into making a vase. So he told his business partner that he had understood that the best thing to do was to make as many vases as possible because then the cost per unit of production would be the lowest. Mm. And effectively discovered the benefits of mass production, you know, unleashing the era of industrialization and, you know, the likes of people like Henry Ford who took that to an extreme.
The next stage, I suppose, was the external reporting of those accounts. When did that first appear? And because it's essentially a form of corporate regulation, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that happened first in Britain in the first sort of legislation to require accountability to investors was in 1842, but it came because of a new form of business. So because of the vast investments required to build railways and canals during the Industrial Revolution, no single entity could finance that anymore. So they had shareholders investing their money on stock exchanges, and hence the rise of the joint stock company. And when various entrepreneurs stole the money of their investors and left for America and the continent and various other places, the investors gradually, you know, agitated and demanded from the British Parliament that, you know, there was rules to govern the accountability of these new joint stock companies. So over the period of the 19th century, there are more and more rules for joint stock companies to be accountable to their shareholders. And what did they use to account to their shareholders, but double entry bookkeeping, which proved to be the perfect tool to distinguish between capital and income, and therefore the dividends that weren't the investors were entitled to.
Okay, so you conclude double entry by outlining how GDP, gross domestic product, the measure by which we, you know, gauge growth, fails to account for nature. Nature being, as we call it, an externality. The depletion of the natural environment is not in any way recorded in any of these balance and profit and loss sheets. And you give us a great illustration of this, that the real cost of the McDonald's Big Mac could actually be $200. I think this is Raj Patel from the World Bank who came up with this figure. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So in economics, everybody learns that there's business, and then business has unfortunate externalities which it has no control over, and they are the environment and society. And so Raj Patel, this brilliant economist, made a thought experiment about how much a $4 hamburger really impacts on the world, and therefore how much we should really be paying for it at the drive-by. And once you account for the forests that are destroyed to raise the beef cattle, and the workers who are exploited in Florida to grow the tomatoes, and the various healthcare costs that come after the hamburgers have been eaten in excess, because we know, even though, you know, so we know that they pertain to diseases like diabetes and heart disease. And, you know, as Raj Patel says, diabetes, I think, costs one in every four American healthcare dollars is spent on diabetes. So, you know, that's a massive expense. So if all those costs were taken into account, because they are paid, as Raj Patel says, but just that the McDonald's corporation doesn't pay them, we do, in all the sort of social costs, government costs, the destruction of the environment. If the McDonald's corporation was forced to pay them, we would be paying $200 for every hamburger. And, you know, in the free market vision of, you know, free market economists, it means that the price signal would be right. So we would not be just casually driving through on our way home from work to have a random Big Mac because it would cost $200, you know. So that would be signalling to us that this is actually a very expensive thing to buy.
It's a metaphor, really, isn't it, for the modern age?
Absolutely. And, you know, the fascinating thing was that double entry bookkeeping, as you suggest, as you said, was applied to national accounting during the Depression and the Second World War, and we now we run our governments, our countries, on the rises and fall in GDP accounts. But both at that level and at the level of corporations, all the other things that are costed into that $200 hamburger are invisible. So we have an incentive to destroy forests. We have an incentive to, you know, ruin our health. We have an incentive to let our, you know, now in the new six capital model, our social capital run down, you know, destroy our, like, overwork our workers because we don't pay, well, business and doesn't pay those costs. And in GDP terms, they're seen as economic growth.
We'll talk about the six capitals and what you mean by that in a moment. But first of all, let's talk about the three waves of wealth creation. The first wave being the agricultural writing and single entry bookkeeping. The second wave is the Industrial Revolution, printing press, double entry bookkeeping. The third wave, the information age, the digital age, and so on. This draws on Alvin Toffler's book, The Third Wave. But importantly, you make the point that each wave requires a different form of accounting. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, that was a fascinating thing that I was, you know, it was actually an accountant in New York who wrote about the problems he was finding in accounting for business in the late 20th century and realised that it made sense in terms of this bigger overlay that Alvin Toffler puts on history. So in early societies, agricultural societies, they only need to record the exchange of goods. So that is a single entry bookkeeping, and that evolved in Mesopotamia. And, you know, I had written about it in double entry bookkeeping without seeing it in through the lens of these three waves of wealth creation. But during the mercantile area that we've been talking about in northern Italy, more information was needed because there were debtors and creditors, and you needed to have information about, you know, future investments and when your creditor was going to pay back your money. And so the double entry bookkeeping system emerged to account for the bigger forms of trade and the more complex business dealings with banking and finance and those various other things. Yeah, as you said, the technology of that era was the printing press, and then it was applied to the Industrial Revolution, and that was the double entry bookkeeping system. And it measures financial and manufactured capital. So it measures the plant and equipment of the industrial age, and it measures the rises and fall in money that were accounted for during the mercantile era and that we still use to account for financial transactions. But after the advent of the network computer in the 1950s, a new sort of, well, that is a new information age with electronic information, and it caused this accountant writing in New York in 1992 enormous problems with valuing companies, because suddenly companies which in the 1980s were fully represented, their value was fully represented in their financial accounts, you know, those bequeathed by Luca Pacioli's double entry bookkeeping, could capture about 80 or 90% of a company's value. Yep. Suddenly in the 1990s with the dot-com boom and all this other intangible wealth, which was the wealth of the information age, accounts only started to capture, well, could only capture 30 and 40% of a company's wealth. So they realized, these accountants, that there was a whole lot of wealth that was no longer being recorded in the traditional double entry bookkeeping system. So this particular accountant hypothesized that there needed to be a new form of accounting that could capture what I call in my book the dark matter, you know, the missing wealth of the information age.
Intellectual capital, for example, and it's very hard to value, isn't it?
Because this is all the new capitals are hard to value. So the two that are brought by the information age are intellectual capital, as you just said, and human capital. So it's geeks and their software. And it's very hard to value because it's not traded, and it only acquires a value when it's traded. For example, when I think it was Microsoft bought a whole lot of patents for, you know, development of internet software from, I can't remember what the company was, but, you know, for billions of dollars. And that was the first time that those software patents, which hadn't yet been realized in, you know, hadn't yet been applied, that was the first time they had a dollar value. So that was the first time anyone knew what they were worth. But in just sitting in the accounts of, or just sitting in the, you know, not even being accounted for, but sitting in the brains of the geeks who invented it, there's no way to value them. So, I mean, we see it in action when, you know, people are bamboozled that Twitter, for example, can list on stock exchanges for astronomical prices, and it doesn't have a cash flow, it doesn't have any assets on its balance sheet. In traditional financial accounting terms, it's useless. And yet, you know, it skyrockets up the stock exchange valuations and is way more valuable than traditional industrial manufacturing companies, you know, which are more solid in traditional financial accounting terms.
But it's based on no way of actually measuring what it's worth.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
So the new accounting paradigm, which brings, you know, six capitals, those two, and then the two new ones brought by the sorts of problems we were talking about with a $200 hamburger, which are natural capital, which is the environment, and social and relationship capital, which is, you know, the way that businesses impact societies. And, you know, I can talk a bit more about that in a minute, but the problem with these new capitals, so intellectual, human, social and relationship, and natural, is that we really have no way of measuring them, certainly not yet, although natural capital is probably the most advanced because they're actual physical measures for things. We know how to measure carbon emissions, and measures for water are being developed. So it's the physical world, but anything that relates to the human mind and human beings, you know, because we don't trade ourselves on stock exchanges, you know, I mean, we are implicitly valued, given a cost, you know, a dollar value in insurance policies and other things. So it is possible, but it's such complex, sort of metaphysically and ethically explosive ground, really, to value these other things.
Well, we know, for example, like when Steve Jobs died at the head of Apple, the value of the company fell by a significant amount of money, and that was the value of him.
Yeah.
What was in his brain, what he was capable of doing.
Yeah.
That was one way, I suppose, of valuing what his contribution
was.
But you know, it is very hard to measure that sort of stuff that people bring to the table.
Part of me thinks it's impossible, and another part of me also knows, having studied the history of double entry bookkeeping and knowing the context, that it also took a century for the 19th century industrialists to work out how to measure industrial capital. So it took them 100 years. And, you know, the value of a human labour hour is also an arbitrary thing, and we have arrived at that value through negotiation and labour unions and various, you know, histories over the last 200 years. So part of me knows that all valuation is arbitrary, and another part of me thinks, well, to start, you know, having, you know, if you come to a company and you bring your human capital and it's worth so many thousands or hundreds or, you know, dollars, that just feels like a very strange, you know, for want of a better cliche, Orwellian type of way of understanding human beings, or probably not even Orwellian, it's probably more Aldous Huxley-esque.
So the six capitals, the two accepted forms of capital, financial capital and manufactured capital, we all know about that.
Yep.
And then these four additional forms of capital that you've put in the book, intellectual, human, social and relationship and natural capital. We'll talk about natural capital in a minute. I think people roughly know what we're talking about there. But the difference between human and social and relationship capital and intellectual capital, they're all sort of overlapping, aren't they, really?
Because they're all bound up in human beings.
Yeah.
And the reason that those six capitals are in the book is because a global coalition of accountants, business people and various other interested parties published at the end of last year a new accounting framework that ask corporations to account for these six forms of wealth, which they call six capitals. And so that, to me, seems like a landmark event equivalent to Luca Pacioli's publication of his treatise on double entry bookkeeping. So now we have to work out how to do it. Mm. But what they're acknowledging is that all these things are now cogent for corporations. They now directly affect their value, not just in sort of nebulous terms, uncapturable terms, but actually on the bottom line. These things now affect the bottom line. So they want companies to account for their intellectual property, especially these new age companies, you know, the software and their, and, you know, so intellectual capital is usefully thought of in through its corollary, which is intellectual property, you know, the legal structures that are being developed to value intellectual property. So that's becoming well developed, even though we still don't know how to value it. But so intellectual property, intellectual capital are songs, films, you know, radio shows, it's all the products of the human mind. So that is quite easy to imagine. It's harder to account for. But human capital and social and relationship capital definitely, you know, merge. But in the terms of the accounting framework that was published last year, human capital is everything that a human being brings to it, his or her work, you know, to a business. So it's both our intelligence, our education, our health, our willingness to work, our belief in the company's ethos. It's all those sort of emotional, physical, intellectual things that we bring to a company. And then social and relationship capital are the relationships that the company has with its community, with its stakeholders, which is a new word to distinguish interested parties from shareholders. So it's their customers, it's their suppliers, you know, the people who supply the various parts of their products, and it's their communities more generally. So, for example, you know, in South Africa, where this new form of accounting was pioneered really in the post-apartheid era, you know, because corporations needed to be guided to move beyond discrimination into a new era. So companies were asked to consider their social and relationship capital, which included how they were advocating black employment, you know, how they were employing the newly enfranchised citizens of South Africa, how they were dealing with the biggest problem of South Africa, which still is, you know, HIV/AIDS. So all sorts of, so that was social and relationship capital. How were they engaging with their communities and dealing with these critical issues? So what might previously have been problems for a government were then also becoming problems for individual corporations.
Yes, it's accounting for non-financial value in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that the key point that you talk about in this context in the book is natural capital. Now, many people, environmentalists and those committed to ecological sustainability, have been banging on for years about this idea that we have to put a price on natural capital, on externalities. But what is significant about your book is that you say that international corporate accounting practice is actually changing, modifying its guidelines to accommodate this. This is very new, but there's quite a bit happening in this regard, a surprising amount, I must say, from reading your book.
Yeah, well, that was because, as you sort of implied at the beginning, Double Entry ended up on that note. It looked, because at the GDP level, people like Sarkozy in France and the great Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz had started to consider bringing nature into the balance sheet, effectively, of GDP accounts. So it was already being mooted then. And that was, so my book came out in 2011. That people were still very sceptical about it. When I went to talk about it in Europe and the UK, you know, I think The Economist said, we just won't talk about those last two chapters in the Wall Street Journals, mocked it. That was the beginning of 2012. That year, the UN made natural capital accounting the equivalent to GDP accounting. It declared it as, you know, so the first new measure of national wealth since the Second World War, well, the second and only other measure was declared to be natural capital. The same year, a group of 40 financial institutions from around the world signed the Natural Capital Declaration, saying that they and businesses would seek to account for natural capital by 2020. So suddenly, I think it was a combination of the global financial crisis and the increasingly obvious environmental crisis, various weather events and, you know, droughts and floods and landslides, made corporations realize that this actually was no longer a non-financial matter. This was actually a financial matter. It actually bore directly on their bottom line whether, for example, Coca-Cola, which was a pilot company developing this new accounting framework, whether they could guarantee a supply of fresh water, which is essential for their manufacturing, 20, 30 years down the track. And if they couldn't, their shareholders need to know about it.
So there is an incentive on Coca-Cola ensuring that there is a virtually sustainable supply of fresh water for their
and
product.
Is an incentive for them to recycle and to really value and care for their sources of water. And, you know, when I was asked to the roundtable meeting, of all places, in a hedge fund roundtable in New York, and I found Moody's rating agents, you know, at the heartland of capitalism, people were wanting now, you know, investors now need to know the environmental practices of the businesses they're investing in, because if they're not caring about their water in the long term, if they're only caring about their next you know, quarterly report, then the investors are no longer interested.
So natural capital, we're talking about fresh water, clean air, fertile soil, fish stocks, forests, and so on. You say the UN now considers natural capital as a statistical measurement to be of equal value to GDP. What does that actually mean, though?
Yeah, that is such a fantastic question, Paul, because what does it actually mean? It actually means, at the moment, not very much. But as with GDP accounting, you know, first of all, it was only done by the UK. Those were nascent endeavours during the Depression and the Second World War that, following the Second World War, gradually spread around the world, and every nation began to construct GDP accounts. So no nation has yet constructed what's called an environmental and economic account yet, national account. But the guidelines they were published in February this year by the UN, and it advises that countries need to do this. And certainly the UK is leading the way. Australia is considering it. Various countries are developing these accounts. And in fact, Australia is quite advanced in its actual measurement of physical natural capital. So it's not necessarily giving monetary measures to natural capital, but it is taking a stock take of all the natural wealth of, for example, Australia, our forests, our waterways, our clean air, our soils, all the natural assets of the country, which, you know, in accounting parlance, they are. So the two systems, the environmental system and the economic GDP accounts, are able to be, you know, they've been created so they can kind of speak to each other, for want of a better word, and that so that the environmental measures can direct economic policy, and economic policy will bear upon, you know, how we use our environmental resources. So, I mean, really at the heart of the six capitals paradigm for corporations and the Natural Capital Initiative at the GDP level is an attempt to get natural and other, what you've called non-financial values, to speak to financial values. So the things that are invisible because we don't value them in money now need to be brought to the table and bear upon policy decisions and corporate decisions.
And so ultimately you would have basically non-financial and financial statements sort of fused. You'd have accounting for everything in the one document, essentially.
It changes the way everybody thinks. So suddenly the CEO has to start thinking, oh, how are we using our fuel supplies and how are we using our lighting and how are we using our water? So it also starts, so it's not only for information for investors, it also actually starts changing the way that corporations behave and people within them behave. And it brings the people who are responsible for the sustainability reports to the table with the chief financial officer and the CEO, and they all then have to start realizing that what they each do bears upon the other.
This is Big Ideas, Paul Barclay with you. My guest is Jane Gleeson-White, and we're discussing her book, Six Capitals, The Revolution Capitalism Has to Have, or Can Accountants Save the Planet? It was Bobby Kennedy who said in 1968, and this is really one of the great quotes, he says of the gross national product, which is the US equivalent of our GDP, that it measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I suppose the point he's making is that what it doesn't measure and what we are now seeking to put a measure on is exceptionally difficult to measure. So it's one thing to say that we should measure the value of the natural environment, but how do you put a value on a river or on a butterfly or on, you know, clean water? And how do you even begin to do so?
You know, the question sort of is so morally loaded and fraught, enormous debates have exploded around it. For example, Puma is one company, the sporting goods company, has published in 2011 the world's first environmental profit and loss account. And it tried to put monetary values on its carbon emissions, which is not such a hard one because Europe has a price on carbon. So it's carbon emissions, it's water usage, it's land usage, all its usage of, in the terms of one of the advocates of natural capital accounting, its usage of Mother Nature, you know. So the way it uses nature, it accounted for. So it put a price on everything. And there's an organisation in the UK that has been, you know, evolving measures for natural capital since the 1990s called True Cost. And True Cost was the one that put a value on Puma's use of nature in its business. And, you know, for example, in Costa Rica, there's a really interesting experiment that valued their forests, you know, which were being cut down for McDonald's hamburgers because they were for grazing beef cattle in the 1970s. So the forestry minister went to the finance minister and said, we have to stop cutting down our forests, we're destroying our environment, in the late 1990s. And the finance minister was, you know, deaf to this appeal because it was about nature and beauty and it meant nothing to him. So the finance minister went away and worked out the value of the forest in terms of what they brought in environmental tourism and also in terms of their value for hydroelectricity, because they, you know, directed the water to the rivers and they protected the rivers and their roots held the water in the river systems. So he went back to the finance minister and said, you know, actually our forests left standing are worth far more than they are being cut down for beef cattle grazing, and they're worth this amount of, you know, these many dollars. And that changed Costa Rica's policy on its forests for, you know, until today. And forestry cover not only was restored, but it was increased. And, you know, so that was an early example of natural cost accounting. And those sorts of ways of valuing nature are used by True Cost and were used by Puma. And in fact, Puma found that its environmental cost was nearly $200 million, which is 2/3 of its profits. So, you know, that is a massive amount of money. And the UK is now doing similar experiments in natural capital accounting. It's actually leading the way at the moment.
They haven't gone quite down the road, though, Puma, of integrated accounting, of bringing those financial and non-financial. They're just at the moment putting it out there what the cost to the environment is. nonetheless, it's still quite a progressive thing to do. The CEO of Puma must be a fairly forward-looking, progressive CEO to actually even put that number out there on the
exactly.
books.
He's one of those bouncy energy bunny type Richard Branson people, and he's actually one of Richard Branson's very good friends now. I think he did this when he was about 30. You know, he's just a complete dynamo, this German. Yeah, I suppose visionary in the way that, you know, I did discover writing this book that from within the heartland of capitalism, there are visionary entrepreneurs who are trying to deal with all the serious problems they see around us that are not being dealt with by government. So he is definitely one of them. And he used it as much as a kind of signal of what we should be considering in the 21st century in terms of business, and in a sort of a marketing exercise as well, because, you know, this is what Puma's doing. But although he didn't integrate it into his financial accounts and subtract those costs from his final profit figures, he does use the findings to direct the policy on their sporting goods. So he used that to demonstrate that eventually Puma would have to stop using leather in their sneakers and cotton in their shirts because the cost to the environment was too great. So, you know, in the same way that natural capital accounting at the national level is supposed to eventually direct government policy, so this exercise was directing Puma's corporate policy.
There are some people, and a good example is the British writer and environmentalist George Monbiot, who do not agree with putting a monetary value on the environment. And he sees it very much as privatising and commodifying nature, that why should everything have a monetary value? Is there a danger that in valuing nature that we, in a sense, remove nature from the commons, commodifying it and privatising it?
Yeah, that is the best question, and it had me up all night long. It had me in, you know, long dark nights of the soul answering that question that posed by George Monbiot, because the advocates of natural capital accounting say, no, this is a hysterical response. We implicitly value all sorts of things like human beings for insurance policies, and we don't get traded. So this does not mean necessarily that nature will eventually be commodified and traded. But in the way that this is currently being done by the UK, which is at a national level leading this new natural capital accounting initiative post the UN's declaration in 2012, it does seem that George Monbiot is right, because there are various natural capital task force and, you know, horribly dense papers that I've read, and definitely as part of their mission are what they call the financialization of nature and the legal underpinnings for it. And legal underpinnings, of course, always come along when private property is, you know, being newly partitioned off. So I think Monbiot is absolutely right to be really concerned about the implications in terms of commodification of nature, and worse, it's the possibilities of its financialization and trading on futures exchanges and, you know, being co-opted into the financial system. And we know how well the financial system has been looking after its primary responsibility, which is money. So, you know, I mean, I'm being sarcastic here because of 2008. So
I suppose the corollary of something is, if something only has value if you put a financial value on it, what happens if you can't put a financial value on it? Does that mean it has no value at
all?
Well,
that's, yeah. I mean, the advocates of natural capital accounting. So at the other end, one of George Monbiot's sort of antagonists, not antagonists, but, you know, the person who often replies to him, is a longtime environmentalist, Tony Juniper. And he worked in the Costa Rican experiment, and he has found for the first time in his 40 years of campaigning in natural capital accounting, the first time ever that he's had a language to speak to financial people. So for him, it is the first time that nature has become visible in the argument, that it has a language to speak to economists. And his argument is, it's not environmentalists that need to learn anything. It's, you know, business people, accountants,
he's very optimistic about this, isn't
he? He's very optimistic.
He spends decades and decades as an environmentalist banging his head against a brick wall, losing campaign after campaign.
Because the beauty of nature has no place in a financial argument.
And all of a sudden, by measuring the value of nature financially, he starts to see some progress being made.
Yeah.
It's a paradox, isn't it?
Well, it's such a hairy one. And, you know, Robert Costanza, who's another big advocate of natural capital accounting, he argues, you know, with Tony Juniper. But they all the advocates do express reservations about the way it's currently being implemented by the Cameron government. So like anything, it's a double-edged sword and it depends who uses it.
Mm. Let's talk about the corporation, because it is the giant multinational corporation that really runs the show. 51 of the largest economies in the world are not countries, they are corporations. Mm. Pretty scary statistic, isn't it?
That was, a surprise.
And it is profit maximisation alone that pretty much drives corporations. In fact, they are obliged, aren't they, by law, essentially, to be driven by the profit motive.
Yeah.
So if that's what's driving them legally, that they have to act in the best interests of the shareholder in terms of making money, how do you then get them to bring some of these social obligations and environmental obligations into play?
Yeah. Well, that's the best question of all and the one that really drove me because this new accounting model of Six Capitals, which asks corporations to consider these externalities, nature and the society, purports to force profit-driven corporations to consider them just by imposing this new accounting framework on them. But when the framework was published last year and when I read all that, because it was developed over 4 years, and when I read all the sort of people who'd commented on it during the process of its development, I realised that ultimately this framework was only serving financial capital in the end, that really it was all about, you know, accounting for nature and society only so that investors could work out where their profits were most likely to be the greatest. So it's not actually in the name of nature and society, it's in the name of financial capital. And that led me to discover two interesting things. One, the fact that really profit maximisation was so bound up in the law. In the case of Henry Ford, the Ford Motor Car Company in 1919, Henry Ford was taken to court by two of his shareholders because he wanted to invest his profits back into the company, into his workers, pay them better money, have better working conditions. And he was sued by the Dodge brothers because they said, no, you need to pay those profits out to us in dividends. And the court found in favour of the Dodge brothers, made Henry Ford pay millions of dollars in dividends to them, which they then invested in their Dodge company. And the court said businesses cannot be run as charities. They have to be run for shareholders and therefore for the maximisation of profits. Mm. So that became enshrined in US case law, and it effectively underpins corporate law throughout the world to a lesser or greater degree. And three entrepreneurs in America found this to their horror when they tried to sell a sort of benign sporting goods company that they had developed. I think they tried to sell it in the mid-2000s. Around 2002 or something, and they paid their workers 10% more than the going rate. They invested back into their communities, and they thought that that was sort of embedded in their corporation, that they could sell their corporation and those things would be enshrined in it. But they found that the minute it was for sale, the shareholders' demands were that all those, you know, beneficent practices had to be unraveled and the money go to the shareholders. So they thought, wow, this is so outrageous. We and many of our colleagues are trying to work for, you know, a higher purpose, and we're legally obliged to maximise profits. Mm. So they conceived of a new form of corporation, and that was really where I started to think that something seriously significant was changing, because from 2007 in America, they started an organisation called B-Lab to go around America to change state legislatures, which are responsible for incorporation in America, unlike here, which is a national legislation, to ask them to change their legislation so that corporations could be incorporated, businesses could be incorporated with a legal obligation to maximise profits, benefit to society and benefit to nature. Mm. And these new corporations are called benefit corporations. And a lot of people have been very sceptical when I've talked about them. And I might be too, but, you know, they have to account for three bottom lines, you know, which is social, environmental and financial. And when you read the stories about these corporations, they really are doing things differently. And it's a very American thing to believe in the power of the entrepreneurial spirit to solve everything that governments can't. And I suppose this is an offshoot of that sort of thinking. But it is very inspiring, you know, and it. So there are two things happening. One, a new form of corporation more equipped for the needs of the 21st century, you know, given that the other one is an industrial style corporation which evolved in the 19th century purely to maximize the production of stuff and of profits, you know, under the Josiah Wedgwood revelation of mass production. So this is a new form of corporation. And also the people who are using it are a new generation of entrepreneurs who already want to have a social environmental purpose. So the very first state, I think it was Vermont, was one of the first states to legislate. And the governor said he wanted to do this, you know, because, you know, the world has changed in the 21st century. We need a new sort of corporation. And he imagined that in the first year that these new corporations were possible in his state, that maybe 8 or 10 corporations would, you know, incorporate as benefit corporations. I think it was 12 corporations signed up on the very first day the legislation was passed. So they have just taken off in America. They've taken off over the world. And B-Lab opened an office in Melbourne in August this year, and I went to a meeting this week on Tuesday, and I was so inspired by the people I met there and what they were trying to do, you know, do business with an environmental and social conscience, not just paying lip service or greenwashing or, you know, a marketing spin, but actually genuinely trying to make the world a better place. You
know? And would we know the names of any of these companies?
Well, yeah, big important American ones are Patagonia, the sporting goods company, Etsy, the clothing, I mean, the online, you know, company, and Tom and Jerry's ice cream, which everyone seems to know about. I didn't know about it until I started looking into this, but also really fascinating new companies emerging in China to, you know, develop solar-powered cookers. And, you know, I discovered a whole wealth of fascinating, you know, a bread manufacturer in Queens, in New York, which employs anyone, no questions asked. So former ex-cons, former heroin addicts or current, you know, so anyone who comes to this company can get a job, no questions asked.
So are they driven by social and environmental benevolence, or are they driven by self-interest? The example you gave earlier of Coca-Cola, I mean, they're worried about fresh water running out because that would affect their profits. If there's no fresh water, then there's no Coca-Cola. So it's in their self-interest to ensure that's the case. What's driving the benefit corporation? Is it the fact that we need to take into account things like natural capital, because if we don't, our business model collapses? Or are there social values that are underpinning these corporations as well?
I genuinely believe, and it might be naive, but that these people are different and they're not the same as Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is not a benefit corporation.
No.
Coca-Cola is an old-style corporation, you know, imposing a new form of accounting.
Yep.
You know, the day that Coca-Cola becomes a benefit corporation will be a very interesting day.
Yeah, so it's you think, a significant change. It makes me wonder whether or not it will be benefit corporations who change the world with these new accounting models that you've suggested,
yeah,
with integrated financial and non-financial accounting, bringing in the four new capitals that you talk about in the book, rather than governments. Governments seem to be hamstrung by so many problems. In the United States, you know, it is gridlock in the US Congress. It's so hard to get anything done. In Australia, as we've just seen a year and a half ago, a government elected really on the premise of getting rid of putting a price on carbon, for example.
Yeah.
So which something like that, which would go very much against what you've written about in your book. Is it the benefit corporation that ought to give us hope more than government action, in a sense?
Well, it certainly gave me hope. I mean, I have to say, after looking at the accounting paradigm and realizing that it ultimately only served financial capital, and after reading George Monbiot's explosive, you know, impassioned columns for The Guardian, and after, you know, walking many miles and thinking many thoughts about this new accounting paradigm, I was you know, quite despairing until I found, just by chance, at the end, the benefit corporation, which seemed to be the logical outcome of the accounting paradigm. It seemed to embed it in its very sort of DNA, which is the favorite metaphor of these people, so that it couldn't, you know, so if Ford had had a benefit corporation, he would have been able to reinvest in his community and his workers' salaries and his, you know, the improvement of his plant and equipment. So, you know, I mean, another really interesting thing happened. I was in communication with one of the corporate lawyers who works in Silicon Valley and who had written the legislation for California. And he said, you know, he has worked with startups and corporate people his whole life. And there are, you know, these are amazing people. They're model, you know, citizens. Put them in a boardroom in an old-fashioned corporation and they become completely different. They just transform into these ruthless profit-seeking missiles. And he said he just began to think, how did these people, the minute you just put them inside this corporation, they alter completely. And the minute they're out of the boardroom, they're regular people again. So it's like some sort of monster, which it has been likened to. And so he, when he discovered benefit corporations, I mean, he's actually given up his corporate practice to become a sort of evangelist for them, because he, having experienced firsthand how corporations change and alter human behavior, he believes that this new form of corporation is actually giving corporations a conscience. He sees it as an evolution.
Mm. And what role do you think shareholder activism will play in this? Because more and more of us in a country like Australia, for example, have our future savings invested in
Absolutely.
Superannuation funds, which are in turn invested in the large institutional companies. Our financial futures are, in a sense, tied to the returns that those companies get on the dollar. So we have a self-interest, in a sense, in them maximising their profit. But if in maximising their profit they're destroying the environment or not respecting labour rights, then there's a problem. So do you think that we as citizens are prepared to perhaps get less of a financial return and a greater respect for the environment and for you know, social obligations?
I mean, that's a fantastic question, and that is a cultural change that will have to happen, I believe, that we will have to learn to settle for, you know, marginally lower financial returns in favour of investments in society and nature. But it's a way of thinking that's so brand new, I just don't think we appreciate it, because certainly we know that governments are no longer investing in those things. And there, you know, also there is a massive parallel shareholder movement which is demanding this. So there are shareholders who make, you know, responsible investments in, you know, big, I mean, you know, there are new collaborations of investors who are ordering corporations to account, certainly for Six Capitals, and maybe they'll also order them to become benefit corporations. Mm. And when the legislation was passed in Delaware, which is the United States' biggest state of incorporation, which, so that was a landmark event last year, a New York financial management guru was at the launch of the, you know, the new legislation. And he said, this is something that investors have been demanding as well. You know, he said at last, for him, it was a way of having a legally binding clause in a corporation from its very, you know, inception to make a return to society and the environment. Because he, even from the heartland of financial capital, was saying, we know how to make stuff. We've done too much of making stuff. Now we have other problems. We need communities that are healthy. We need, you know, a natural environment that's healthy. We need to consider good education, good healthcare, all these other, you know, we need to reinvest in these things that governments aren't investing in. So, you know, even investment gurus on Wall Street are wise to it. And as far as the rest of us whose money is tied up in these things, I think it's a matter of being wise to it. You know, it's a matter of education and change to realize how closely these problems that we think are out there and externalities actually bear upon our lives really directly.
So finally, in answer to the question that you pose on the front cover of your book, can accountants save the planet? Can they?
Well, I have my favourite politician's answer, yes and no. Well, yes, but only in line with benefit corporations and various other legal changes. But certainly they can lead the way to what the problems are. You know, that's what I felt, that this new accounting paradigm diagnosed the problems that we face today.
Jane Gleeson-White was my guest. Her books are called Six Capitals, the revolution capitalism has to have, or can accountants save the planet? And double entry, how the accountants of Venice created the modern world. You can podcast or stream tonight's discussion and other Big Ideas talks from our website, abc.net.au/rn, and you can follow us on Twitter at RN Big Ideas. That's it for Big Ideas for this week. Thanks to the production team, Karin Zivanovits, Ian Coombe and Sasha Fagan, and operators Peter McMurray and Jim Usher. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
When I say Paul Keating, do you think of this?
This is a recession that Australia had to have.
Or this?
I mean, Mr. Speaker, he's going troppo.
Or maybe Keating's engagement with Asia. Hi, I'm Tom Switzer, and I'll be examining the former PM's foreign policy legacy with Keating biographer David Day on Between the Lines. Online anytime at the RN homepage.